Hi, everybody. My name is Larsine. I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. Oh, I just love Texas. I just absolutely love coming here. There are so many people that are just terrific, just absolutely wonderful. I wish I could just pack you all home and take you with me. And I just can't even say the hospitality here. I've never been any place in Texas where I haven't felt at home almost immediately. And I think you guys are fabulous, and I love you very much. I want to thank, everything was just absolutely, like I say, it's just been absolutely wonderful, and Debbie and James picked us up at the airport and got us over here. They didn't know they were supposed to pick us up, but they got us anyway. We really appreciate that. Thank you. And and then we've been out with Ellen and Dick and Beverly and George, and it's just been wonderful. And there's so many people here that I've gotten to know over, you know, the course of years, and I don't get to see you near as often as I'd like to, but know that I love you, and again, how grateful I am to be here. It's always a little bit hard being the only Al-Anon speaker at an AA conference. You kind of feel like the corpse at an Irish funeral. nobody expects you to say much, but they can't have the party without you. And so, you know, and your AA lineup is just, you know, just absolutely fabulous. I mean, but it kind of cracks me up that you have these two just absolutely Southern gentlemen, actually more than two, and then you have Patty O for your spiritual closing speaker. I mean, I'm just like, there was no Al-Anon contribution to that part of the program, I'm sure. But anyway, it's always really fun to come. I get to do this every so often, and most of the time they are AA conferences. That always kind of ticks me off a little bit, because everywhere you go, there's a giant AA banner, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous. And then on the flyer, in little tiny print, it says, with Al-Anon participation, you know. And that always kind of pisses me off a lot, you know, because it's like, boy, when you guys were in jail, you wanted some Al-Anon participation. Yeah. No money in the wallet, we want some Al-Anon participation, you know, so. But I am grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous more than words can ever say. I love AA. I love going to AA meetings, and I cannot recommend enough, especially to new people in Al-Anon, to go to open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says in our Al-Anon literature that we should learn all that we can about the disease of alcoholism. And as far as I'm concerned, there's no better place to learn that than in open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have learned so many valuable things that I've been able to bring into my life from the generosity of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just want AA to know before I start talking that I really do love you very, very, very much. May get lost a little bit in there, but I do. So I'm just going to leap into this deal and just tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like for me today. I'm the oldest of four kids, and my dad was a master sergeant in the Army, so that made me the automatic corporal of my family. You know, my husband jokes that I came out of the womb carrying a clipboard and wearing an armband, and he's not too far off the mark. Ever since I can remember, when I was in school, I was always room monitor, cafeteria monitor, playground monitor, because I'm very good at writing what other people do wrong. I write it down, and I can't wait to report it. I mean, I live for that, and Al-Anon is where I absolutely positively needed to be. There's no doubt about that, but I was always that way, and it didn't matter, you know, if the kids were bigger than me or older than me or they were boys. If they did something wrong, by God, their name was going down on the list and they were getting told on, because I grew up with a lot of rules and a lot of regulations. And for me, and I say this just for me because my sisters and my brother did not go near as well, but I liked it. I like knowing what you want me to do. I like having a piece of paper. I love instructions. You know, it's just, sure, just give me the piece of paper that tells me where we're supposed to go, what we're supposed to do, how we're supposed to get there. And I just couldn't be happier. And pretty much that's kind of been that's my life, that's what I do. I had to go to meetings for 3 years before I could leave the 6 items or less aisle alone, you know, and not go near there. Or even when I have a full cart full of groceries, I still got to buzz by there and see who's violating the regulations. You know, it's a sickness, I know, today, but I'm working on it. But anyway, I grew up in this family, and like I say, my dad was a master sergeant. He just ruled our family with an iron fist. My dad was also a daily drinker. I had no idea that my dad was alcoholic or that it was even a problem in our home, because that's just the home that I grew up in. I just arrived there, and that's all the knowledge that I had, and that's, as far as I was concerned, how all homes were. Dad drinks, he gets drunk, he yells at mom, he yells at us, you know, and that's just the way that dads operate, and that's just kind of what goes on. And again, I didn't think that there was anything wrong with it. It was just the home that I grew up in. And when I was really new in Al-Anon, I went to a lot of open AA meetings, and I heard one speaker one night, an AA speaker, and I, you know, again, I can't tell you everything he said, but I do remember it seemed to me that his whole talk was about alcoholism, the family disease. That's what his talk was about. And he described alcoholism in the home as like having a rhinoceros in your living room, but everybody pretends it's a coffee table. And you couldn't describe the house that I grew up in any better than that. Because my dad would get to the point where he was ready to have one of his alcoholic explosions, and my mom would know that this was coming. And she could never say to us kids, you know, now don't anybody say anything or do anything because your dad's ready to blow up, because that, of course, would have caused, my dad would blow up just because my mom said something. So my mom, you know, the first thing that I know that goes away in alcoholic homes is it really any kind of form of verbal communication. So my mom would facially communicate to us, you know, that there was trouble. So, you know, we'd be at the dinner table and my mom would, you know, this kind of stuff. And it's not an epileptic fit, you know, it's warning, warning. And, of course, us kids all knew it, you know, so everybody would just look down at their plate, nobody would look up. But, you know, if you got an alcoholic that wants to blow up, it's going to happen anyway. And somebody would do some minor offense, you know, scratch a knife on a plate, spill some milk, and ba-boom. You know, dinner would go flying, everybody would get a spanking, everybody would be yelled and screamed at and cursed at, and we'd all have to go to bed. At 5 o'clock in the afternoon, we all got to go to bed. The kids, my mom, the dog, everybody's got to go. You know, and then the next morning you wake up and you get up the courage to creep down the hallway into the kitchen, and there's my dad with his breakfast beer, and it would just be like, good morning, what do you want for breakfast? And no one ever said, gee whiz, what was that about last night, Dad? Gee whiz, how come you had to hit everybody? How come you had to throw dinner on the floor? You know, nobody said anything because you just want it to be over, and the rhinoceros just goes back to being a coffee table again. You know, and again, that's just the absolutely perfect description of how it was in our house. And my dad was a very verbally and physically abusive person, and for a long time I could never understand why my mom would put up with some of the things that she did and subject her children, you know, to some of the things, you know, that my dad did. And my mom finally ended up divorcing my dad after I was gone and married, and I was very, very fearful of my mom, for my mom, because my dad was always going to kill her. If you ever leave me, I'm killing you. That was my dad's big thing, was to kill us all the time. And so I just really, and I said to her, so I said, you know, aren't you really afraid that dad's going to kill you? And, you know, and it just kind of shows you how alcoholism, the family disease, because my mom said, you know, I've gotten to the point where I'd rather be dead than live this way one more day. You know, and that's the path that my mom had to go on. And anyway, and they got divorced, and my dad didn't kill her. It was all a big show. But at any rate, but my dad was, like I said, he was a master sergeant. He was in missiles and tanks and all this stuff, and he always had, like, rocket fuel and hand grenades and stuff like that laying around. And again, normal behavior in our house. I didn't think it was anything unusual. And, you know, we finally got old enough to date. My dad had lots and lots of rules and regulations about dating, and we had to bring these little weenie guys in to meet my dad. And my dad was over 6 foot tall, and he had one eyebrow. He could raise like 6 inches off of his forehead. So he just looked like Satan himself standing there, you know. And he'd be talking to these little weenie guys, and he'd have a sawed-off shotgun on the table or a hand grenade or some kind of bizarre thing. You know, which we didn't think was any big deal, but apparently it freaked these guys out. And because he'd be standing over there, you know, telling them the rules and regulations about dating his daughters, where are you going, what time are you going to be back, and what part of their anatomy he would remove if we were not returned in the virginal condition of which we left the house. I mean, it was pretty straightforward rules and regulations. I didn't know what all the hubbub was about. But so anyway, it was really hard to get a second date in my house. It was almost impossible. Guys would bring us home, thank you very much, never see him again. That would kind of be the deal. And, you know, and that's kind of, again, where my mom, you know, where for many, many years I thought my mom did nothing. I thought she absolutely did nothing. And what I know is that, you know, my mom was married to the alcoholic variety that was angry and explicit physically and verbally. And I watched my mom, now that I'm away from it and can look back, You know, I watched my mom try and do everything that she could in her power to make our life as children as normal as she possibly could. And so my mom would lie for us, and she would cover up for us, and so that we could get to do some of these things that were going on, you know. Needless to say, I was an overachiever in school, you know, but I would never have my parents come to any of the assemblies or any of the awards things at the end of the school year, because if you've ever had a drunken father show up at a school function, then you know that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization is just not reserved for the alcoholic. And, you know, and so my mom, you know, she would hide my certificates and, you know, and do all this kind of stuff. You know, today, when I came into Al-Anon, you know, I had a hard time with my mom. I thought that, you know, it was her fault that we had to go through so much of this stuff and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I remember one time asking my mom, gee, Mom, why did you stay married to Dad for so long? You know, and my sisters were there, and she says, well, I stayed married because of you kids. You know, and we were like, gee whiz, thanks. What can we get you for Christmas next year? You know, it was just like this. But you know what I know is this is in the 50s, you know, and back then that's just you did what you did. And, you know, and she didn't have the services, you know, and the knowledge that's available to us today. I mean, the fact that we know that there are recovery programs out there. My mom never heard of Al-Anon, never heard of anything like that. My mom grew up in a world where this is your life, you made your bed, you sleep in it, and you do the very best with what you got. You know, and it's because of that, you know, and because of coming to these meetings and hearing older women share in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was new, that there was a lot of healing and forgiveness between my mother and I. Now, my mom is not very, very fond of Al-Anon to this day. She personally thinks it's a brainwashing, you know, you guys are just brainwashing people. I told her, Mom, whose brain needs more washing than mine? I do not know. But but my mom has accepted Al-Anon and the fact that I participate in it to the level that I do because it makes me happy. And because my mom really does love me and care about me, she accepts the fact that I am happy here. She absolutely thinks it's just the biggest abomination for me to share any family crap from this here podium. And so my mother has not given me the seal of approval to say anything that I'm saying. But I'm here to tell you that my mom did the very best she could with what she had. She is a loving, warm woman, and I'm very, very close to her because of you. Because I've learned in Al-Anon, it's my job to be the best daughter that I know how to be. And because of you, the things you have taught me, I let her be the best mom that she knows how to be. And believe you, she is more than that to me. And I can't thank you enough for the relationship that I have with my mom today that got healed here. But anyway, you know, my dad was a whole nother different story. We were just pretty much terrified of him. There's just no other way to get around it. And my dad died when I was 1 year in Al-Anon. He died at 55. He died the death that they talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, total insanity, and then death. And it was not pretty. I can't even tell you the last words that my father said to me because it was that vulgar. And it's just not repeatable from this podium. But I was only in Al-Anon a year, so I wasn't to the loving, forgiving part of the program yet. And my idea when he died, and my sisters, I mean, we were all at the hospital, and we were like, ding dong, the witch is dead, witch old witch, the wicked witch. And I'm telling you because this is the truth. This is exactly how we felt. But what I came to find over that is that, because see, I thought when my dad died, the reign of terror would be over. I thought that would be it, and it would be over. You know, I had absolutely no idea that my dad suffered from a horrible disease called alcoholism. And I had to do a lot of work in Al-Anon about that. And, I just thought when he died, the deal would be done. And if that worked, then none of us would really need to be in an Al-Anon meeting. We'd all be at the penitentiary, you know, because just kill him and be done with it, and we'll all go to jail together and be happy there. But, you know, so I'm telling you this because if you're thinking about killing them, don't waste your time. You're still going to have all the problem. Nothing's going to change there. But I did a lot of writing, and I did a lot of work about stuff about my dad and my resentments, you know, and just, you know, because I could never understand why a man would go to the trouble to marry somebody and have children and just to be mean to them and say mean things to them. I just didn't understand what that was all about. Like I say, I didn't know anything about the disease of alcoholism. But I did a lot of work on it, and I did a lot of writing about it. And still, I would just get these horrible feelings, just icky feelings, just make me feel bad when I would think about, you know, something would happen, and I just, this little thing about when we were little and this and that, and it would just make me feel terrible. And I remember one time talking to my about it. She said to me, you know, you've done all the writing and we've done the inventory and everything else on that, and I'm really satisfied about the footwork you've done on this thing. She says, but now we need to get out of what happened and we need to get into the solution. So she goes, what I want you to do from now on is, she says, I want you to go home and I want you to think about some nice thing your dad did. You know, and my initial reaction was, no way. And what I know about the family disease of alcoholism is it is a negative disease. You know, alcoholism, the family disease, only wants you to see the bad that's going on all the time. That's how the family disease part of it works. And so I didn't think that I could come up with anything, but I took on the assignment, and I don't know how long it took me, a couple of weeks, and I remembered that my dad taught me how to drive. You know, so if you're going to live in Southern California and you're going to marry an alcoholic later on, knowing how to drive, very crucial tool. You must know this. And so I came back to her and I said, well, you know, he did teach me how to drive and I'm very, very grateful for that. And she says, that's fabulous, wonderful. She goes, now whenever those unwholesome feelings, when you start all that bad stuff, you start feeling that stuff again. She goes, I want you to replace that negative thing that happened with this positive thing that your dad taught you how to do. You know, and it wasn't very much longer after that that I thought of a second good thing that my dad did. And then there was a third thing, and then there was a fourth thing, and then there was a fifth thing. Because like I say, the family disease of alcoholism doesn't want you to see. And what I got out of that exercise and that gift was that I knew that my dad loved me to the very best of his ability, sick, drunk, alcoholic that he was. See, I had an idea. I'd made up these rules and regulations about how a dad is supposed to look and what a dad is supposed to be and what a dad is supposed to do. And my dad was not wrapped like that. He did not come with a bright yellow bow. My dad came in a brown paper sack. But does it make my dad any less valuable than the ones that come in the big yellow bow? You know, because the real gift that comes out of this program for me is the gift of forgiveness. And I was able to forgive my dad, not for his sake, but for my sake. Because I don't know how your life is, but when I'm full of crap and I'm full of unwholesome feelings, and that's what's going on inside, that's what comes out outside. And even though this man is no longer alive, those were still the stuff. And I have children of my own now, so guess who's getting the brunt of those bad feelings and those bad thoughts? So make no mistake about forgiveness. You know, I love in our literature how it says, forgiveness is no favor. We do it for nobody but ourselves. Because forgiveness lets you move on. And that's what I've been able to do. And now when I think about my dad, I think he's in a good place now. And I think he's with his higher power. And I can't wait to see my dad. And I, because my eyes have been opened to so much different stuff and recognize the fact that he was a sick guy. And that's just the way that it was. But it, like I say, for a long time, it was really hard for me. My dad was cremated and military thing and everything. But they brought me the ashes because he had this big thing about he wanted to be planted in a tree where the grandkids could play on and blah, blah, blah. We planted him in a tree. The tree died. Almost instantaneously, but, and that's the truth. And but I remember they brought my dad. They brought the ashes to me, and I was at home alone. And here come that. Okay, the military guys come and they do all the thing, and they salute, and they hand me my dad's ashes, and I was all by myself, and it was just, I just was like, and then I was mad. Oh, I was so mad at him, and I knew he couldn't talk back. And so I took the ashes and I took them down to our garage and I stuck them on the shelf and I said, you sit here and you think about what you did. But you know, today I feel my dad's love and I'm really, really grateful to this program one more time, because where did I learn all this too? From open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, from hearing alcoholics tell terrible stories and terrible things that they did to their family, that they didn't want to do to their family, that the disease of alcoholism means to do to your family. And again, the relationship that I have with my whole family now is based on Larcine being the best daughter she knows how to be, Larcine being the best sister or aunt or whatever my role is supposed to be, and letting those people that I love be exactly who they are supposed to be. But when I was 17 years old, I met my husband. I should have known there was something really wrong with him because my dad liked him right away. And my dad never liked anybody right away. And that went right over my head. And we went on this date with this other couple and we went bowling. And it was impossible not to beat him at bowling. And I remember after we left the bowling alley, we were going to go back to his place. Now, I was 17, he was about 24 at the time, and he's several years older than I am, and he'd been married once before, and we were going to go back to his place, but he was back living with his mom and dad, which might have been clue number two to me that there was something wrong with them, but that went right over my head. And way back to his place, we're with this other couple, and he stopped at a liquor store, and he asked me what I'd like to drink. And I don't drink. I'm 17 years old. There are rules and regulations in the state of California about exactly how old you have to be to drink, and I told him what they were. And but apparently he didn't hear me, and he stopped at a liquor store and got a gallon of Red Mountain wine, if nothing else to impress me what he can consume in sheer volume alone in about an hour's time. But we went back to his house, and we were drinking this wine and playing this card game or something, and I ended up having, I think, about a glass and a half of this wine. And, you know, and again, one more time, you know, I am a rule stickler. And I'm with this guy 3 hours, and I'm breaking a rule already. You know, already he's got me breaking a rule. And again, right over my head. And so anyway, I had about a glass and a half of this wine, and I am not a drinker at all. I mean, a glass and a half of wine, woohoo, happy, happy, happy. And and Butch says I'm a very easy lay, if taste of But not that night, but because there are some rules and regulations. And but anyway, I had my glass and a half of wine, and I'm like out of it. And I remember him driving me back home, and he's at the steering wheel, his hands in the proper 3 o'clock position on the steering wheel, and he's had 10 times what I've had. And I remember right away thinking, this guy can hold his liquor. You know, because I want you to know, I grew up around drinking. I grew up around bar fights, and you know, we'd have these army picnics, and the MPs would show up, and, you know, all this stuff. And I saw all the ugliness, and the wives that were walking around with black eyes and all that stuff. Believe you me, at 17 years old, I knew that I wanted nothing to do with anybody that did that kind of stuff. Absolutely, positively. I was not going to marry anybody like my dad. That was in cement. That was number one rule and regulation. But I watched my husband drive home. And another thing is, see, my husband is a happy guy when he's drinking. He's Mr. Friendly. He's Mr. Nice. There's no mean going on there at all, any way, shape, or form. He's just this wonderful, fun guy. So I do what I've done pretty much all of my life. See, I don't like to ask people things because I don't want to act like I don't know anything. So I just, you know, I call it, it's information floating around the universe, and I just think it up. Lands here, becomes fact for me. And so he was driving, and he drank a lot. He's not like my dad. He doesn't have a problem with drinking, you know, and that's just exactly, you know, where I was focused on. And my husband likes to drink. He likes to drink a lot. You know, we started dating pretty exclusively from that point on. I never went on a date with him that didn't involve alcohol, no matter where we were going. If it had to be smuggled in, snuck in, you know, drink it outside, come back in, or whatever. He was a big-time drinker from the very, very beginning. And it was really hard to date my husband, basically because he had a hard time remembering my name. But if you're going to date an alcoholic, you can't let a little thing like that get in the way. I mean, that's the tip of the iceberg, people, just the tip of the iceberg. And he'd call me Lorraine or something close to that, and it was fine with me. I didn't mind. He knows my name now, don't worry. He's got it down pretty bad. And anyway, so we dated, and, you know, and all this stuff was going on. And I want you to know from the very beginning, my husband was upfront with his drinking. There was no hiding it. He didn't pretend. He's a disappearing drunk. He's a blackout drinker. All of that very, very clear to me in the first month that we were dating. Lots of drugs mixed in on there. You know, it's the early 70s. We're in California. That's what he does. He doesn't hide it. He doesn't pretend. He doesn't do it. And I share this with you because I want you to know that later on, you know, when our life got really, really bad behind the drinking and the drug use and all of that kind of stuff, if you would have said to me, Larsine, did you have any idea that Butch was drinking like he was drinking, that he was a blackout drinker, that he was doing drugs, I would have told you that I had no idea that any of that was going on. You know, because that's how I'm affected by the family disease of alcoholism. Because when the truth gets too hard for me to look at, I just make up new shit. Lands right here, becomes back to me. You know, because that's how I function. That's just how I keep on down my path. That's my family disease, even though I'm not the person that's drinking or using the drugs. Right away, I'll lie, I'll cheat, I'll do whatever just as well, too, to make my story look better than his story, whatever the deal is. And again, that's not anything I'm proud of. I'm just telling you where the family disease of alcoholism took me as well. So we went on this dating thing for a couple of years, and what ended up happening is I ended up getting pregnant. And I share this with you again because later on, when our life got really, really bad behind the drinking, I was sure it was because, you know, I'd broken the big rule and the big regulation of all time. You know, and this was the big punishment from a gotten pregnant, and this is my cross to bear now. And I'm going to be married to this drunken, no good SOB for the rest of my life, and la, 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 because this is the punishment that goes with that. And again, I make up all these ridiculous rules and regulations. I never ask anybody. It just lands here, and it becomes fact for me. And I was in Al-Anon, going into my second year, and we have in Southern California the AFG Southern California Convention, and we do the deal where we get all these Al-Anon women, and we pack as many Al-Anon women into the hotel room as we can, you know, and we were up there that first night. We were having what I call the meeting after the meeting up in the room, and seven of us are in the room, and again, I don't know that this is what's said, that this was what was said, but what I heard was, I heard every woman sharing their deepest, darkest secret with me. You know, it was like we were just doing this group. Don't ask me where, who started or how it came, but that's how the sharing was going around. So when it came around to my turn, I shared with these other six women how I had gotten pregnant when, because, you know, I had to get married because I was pregnant. You know, and out of seven of us in a room, turns out six of us had to get married because we were pregnant. And we decided the seventh was the sickest because she married an alcoholic and did not have to. And, but one more time, you know, you get to learn. You are as sick as your secrets. And because I want you to know that up until that point, what had happened for me is, again, as our life, day after day, month after month, year after year, got progressively worse. Me without a program, me, how I'm affected by the family disease of alcoholism, I started looking at that little boy that I had, and I started blaming that little boy. Because, boy, if I hadn't gotten pregnant with this kid, I wouldn't be stuck with this guy, and I wouldn't be having this crappy life that I'm having right now. And again, not anything that I'm proud of. I'm here to tell you where the disease of alcoholism took me, and I'm not even the person that's drinking. That I would blame a little precious child for the choices that I was making. And the decisions that were only mine to make, it had nothing to do with that kid, because that is the sickness of the family disease of alcoholism. And what I got that day was I got freedom from that, because it's no longer a secret and it's no longer a big deal anymore. And that boy is 31 years old today, and I just absolutely love him as much as a mom can love a son. You know, and again, one more time, I owe all of that to you, absolutely all of the relationship that I have with my family today, to all of you, and I'm really, really grateful. But anyway, I ended up, Butch and I ended up getting married a month after our son was born, and this was good for me, because when you said to me, were you pregnant when you got married? No, I was not. I was not. There was a one-month-old baby at the ceremony, but I didn't have to explain that part. You didn't say, was there a one-month-old baby at the ceremony? You said, were you pregnant when you got married? No, I was not. And that was very, very important, and I wanted you to know that, and every so often I'd be at a work thing, and then Butch would have to come to this work function with me, and all the way to the work function I would tell him, now if somebody asks you what year we got married, you tell them blah, 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 so it works out in the chronological order that I know you want it to work out, so I look good. You know, so I don't know how many parties you've been to, but I've yet to be to one yet where they go, Butch, it's nice to meet you, what year did you and Larsine get married? No one ever seems to care as much as I seem to think that they do. But it's funny, I always like to share this story because several years ago, somebody actually asked Butch how long we were married, and he just looked at me like, oh my God, what do I do? You know, at that point, we've been married like 25 years, you know, and I told him, I've written about it, I've done an inventory, it's okay, you can tell the truth now, honey, you know. But again, one more time. So anyway, Butch and I got married a month after, you know, our son was born. And up until this point, I'd never said anything to him about his drinking or his drugs, nothing. I'd never said one word. But I want you to know that I watched my mom for years do nothing. So I knew the silent treatment was not the way to go. I am proud to report to you that my husband begged for the silent treatment. He never got it, not one time. Not one time. I was like one of those little dogs. It was just like the minute he walked in the door, just nya-nya-nya-nya, and every four-letter combination of words that I could think of. And I don't even know why, but I was positive that if I cursed with the right mothers and effers in the right order, like he would have some spiritual awakening, you know, like, I am so sorry, Larsine, to make my sweet little wife curse like a longshoreman. I will stop drinking immediately, you know. Again, information from nowhere lands here, becomes fact for me, and I start functioning on that kind of stuff. Because from the very beginning, I don't understand why he doesn't come home. Because see, after we're married, and it's him and it's me, and I love him so very much, it's going to be different. It's just going to be different. My love is going to fix it. I mean, I'm just going to love him and take care of him. And But he just wouldn't stay in the same spot long enough for me to do anything, because he's a moving kind of a drunken guy. And one time somebody asked him, Butch, were you a bar drinker or a home drinker? And I answered the question for him, because I am a factual person here and I know all the facts. And I said, he was a bar drinker. And then he turned to the guy and he said, I wanted to be a home drinker, but couldn't go there. Thank you very much for sharing. Yes, I know. Sterling's chin music story just irritated the crap out of me last night. But anyway, but we started, you know, Butch says our little war. It was no little war. It started from the war was on. We took it. There was the Red Army and there was the Blue Army. And I don't have to tell you which was which, and the battle was just on, because it just came my compulsion where he was going. I mean, we aren't even married a week, and I'm supposed to be the bride, and this is our honeymoon, and you know, the first month of our marriage, and the first words out of my mouth every morning are you going to work today? You know, and then off we'd run on this or something, and he would pretend to go to work today just to get out of the house, you know, and drive around the block or do whatever thing that he needed to do, you know, and then wait for me to pack up the baby and then for me to go to work today. And then the games just started, and then I'd leave and then he'd come home. Then I'd come home at lunch, but then he knew I was coming home at lunch, so then he'd leave when I was home at lunch, because he knows my time schedule. Damn. And you know, and just the absolute insanity that goes with all of that. I mean, so then I got tricky. I would leave the TV guide closed when I went to work in the morning, because if I came home and then the TV guide was open, aha. And but aha doesn't mean nothing if they don't come home for 5 days. I mean, it just is like it kind of lost all of its, you know, flavor in there and doing all that kind of stuff. So I tried to help him. I tried to show him how to drink. I sat him at the kitchen table, you know, and stuff like that. And you know, and initially when we were first married, you know, I kind of skipped over this part, but you know, like the day after we were married, to be more precisely, I sat him at the kitchen table and I told him, you know, the rules and regulations of the marriage, because he needed to know those right away. I wanted to be sure he was clear on them. And I told him, you know, I want you to be happy and, you know, and do what you want to do. But, you know, we can't do all this party stuff. We got a kid. We have responsibilities. We have to save money. We have to buy a house. I've got a plan here. And, you know, we're going to babysitter once a month and we'll go out and party. But that's the deal. You know, and I asked him if he understood the rules and regulations of the marriage. You know, he did this, you know, which to me was affirmative. And, you know, what I know today is he was so loaded, his head was just going like this. You know. And he heard what he always hears when I'm talking to him about serious stuff that he doesn't want to hear. He heard blah, 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 blah. You know, and pretty much that was our communication code from that point on. Because like I say, he started disappearing from the very day. The third day of our marriage, he didn't come home for, you know, all night long. The third day we're married, you know, so I know that something has to be done. And, you know, so I started helping him. I sat him at the kitchen table. I pretended to pour myself a glass of whiskey. I took a sip of it. I looked at my watch. I go, oh, it's 6:15, guys, time for me to go home for dinner. Pick up the car keys, walk towards the door, you know. Come back. Can you do that? He gives me the nod. Yeah, I can do it, you know, and stuff like that. Till the next day, 6:15, 7:15, 8:15, 9:15, da, 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 da. And just the insanity and the craziness and the stuff that just keeps going on and on. And I'm not asking anybody and I'm not telling anybody. I'm just thinking this stuff up and it lands here and becomes fact for me. One night he's passed out cold. I spent half the night whispering in his ear, you don't want to drink, you just want to work and bring Larsine the check. You don't want to drink, you just want to work and bring Larsine the check. I mean, thousands of times I probably said it that night. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And it just gets crazier and it just gets crazier and crazier. And I remember one time everybody he associated with, I refer to as scum of the earth people. And one time these people were, well, they weren't, but they were what they were. But anyway, one night they call me. And these were drug connections of my husband's. And they called me. And they, the drug pushers, the drug dealers, my husband was over at their house. And he was so obnoxious and so drunk and so loaded that they, the drug dealers, were going to call the police if I did not come get him. I just want you to know what an absolute pig he could be when he was out there doing this stuff, that the drug dealers were going to call the police. So, of course, I put on my cape and put the baby in the car, and we go to rescue him, and I get there, and the drug dealers, and I'll never forget this, it's still my sweetest, sweetest memory from then, is the drug dealers doing the Al-Anon look through the Venetian blinds to see if I've come to get him. And so anyway. I get him up, and he wanted to drive like he always does, but I just pushed him, and he landed in the back seat of the car, and I drive him home, and I go put our son in his crib, and I come back down, and my husband's made the fatal mistake of getting out of the car without my help. He's fallen in the street, hit his head on the curb, blood is gushing out everywhere. I'd like to tell you how concerned I was for his well-being, but all I wanted to do was get him off the street before anybody saw him. But at this point, you know, he's like 200 pounds of wet washcloth. I mean, there's nothing you can do with him, so I've got him by the ankles, and I'm trying to heave him up and take him down the curb. And why we call these people normies, I have not an idea. I've got a guy by the ankles bleeding out of the head. Some guy, a normie guy, drives by and says, "Are you having a problem?" This is the normie people. And I'm like, my husband's fallen and he can't get up. And so he gets Butch on one side, I get him on the other side, and Butch has a head wound. And I have, again, these rules, these things I make up in my head. We lived in a townhouse, the bedroom's upstairs. Not only do I got to get him in the house, I got to go up a flight of stairs because his head wound must be in bed. You know, so as we're hauling him up this flight of stairs, now the words are flying back and forth between he and I. And Mr. Good Samaritan no longer wishes to participate. And we get to the top of the stairs, and this guy is out of that house like a flash. And so I drag Butch to the bed and get him on the bed. Now I'm looking, and now there's this pool of blood on my bedspread. Now I'm hysterical because now I think I've actually killed him. And, you know, blood is just gushing out all over the place, and it's just a huge mess. And so I'm so hysterical, I call 911. They don't even know what's going on. They sent the police, a hook and ladder truck, the ambulance guys. You know, they even called my mother. Everybody was there. And I'm in the bedroom with the baby, patting the baby, crying, oh my God. And the Redondo Beach police come up to me, and they go, "Mrs. Gantner, your husband says he injured himself because you pushed him down a flight of stairs." And I told the police, "No, I didn't. But if you'll prop him up, I'm happy to push him down right in front of you." And they told me that wouldn't be necessary, and they clean him all up. He's got a little weenie cut. And as it turns out, you know, he needs a couple stitches, but he's too drunk to go any other way, so they're going to take him to the hospital by ambulance. And now, I don't know how your neighborhood is. Friday night, this is 5:30, 6 o'clock, all my neighbors were out front. You know, and Butch comes out on his gurney, his usual friendly, funny self. "Hiya, Fred. Hiya, Joe." You know, he's just Mr. You know, and I come out behind a newspaper like they won't know it's me, because I was really big on anonymity back then. You know, and again, you know, it's just the insanity that just keeps going along with that. And somewhere in all of that craziness, I did call the Council on Alcoholism. And I have no idea why. I can't even tell you what, you know, because again, I don't know what I was looking at or what made me even think about it, but I just ran across the number one day and I called them. And this woman answered the phone, and I told her everything that was going on in my house. First time I'd ever told anybody anything, I told her everything. And no matter what I would say, she would say, "I know, I know, I know, I know." And I know that she said that she asked if she could send me some Al-Anon literature, and I know I gave her the right address because I remember the brown envelope coming into the mail. But from that day to this, that's all I remember. I cannot tell you for the life of me if I ever opened that envelope or looked at a thing. Because see, now I'm doing the rhinoceros elephant thing. Because by the time that brown envelope got to the house, he was being good again, going to work, doing what I wanted him to do. This time it's going to be different, and we're going to be just fine. Thank you very much. And the insidious disease of alcoholism just keeps rolling right along and just rolling right along. And you know, and we had another kid in all this craziness. And somewhere I'd heard about an abuse. Oh, yippee! And I thought, pills, he likes pills, this might work. And so I took him to the doctors, got him all hooked up with Anabuse. That became my daily life, to make sure he took his Anabuse pill every single day, because if you take Anabuse and you drink, you're a dead man. I love to tell him that part. And we played that game for quite a while, until after he'd been on Anabuse almost 2 years and didn't drink, not a drop. Took an exorbitant amount of drugs, but not a drop of alcohol. And what I know today is we got rid of the alcohol, but the ism was alive and well in our house. Absolutely nothing changed. Absolutely nothing was any different than it was. If anything, it was worse. And I remember leaving the doctor's office after the doctor told him he couldn't take Anabuse anymore, and the doctor telling Butch, "I want you to wait 6 months and try some social drinking." And yeah, because it works, right? And so, I don't know that we went 6 days, and it was anything but social. So when they talk about the, when they talk about the progressiveness of the disease of alcoholism, I'm here to tell you, my husband hadn't drank anything for almost 2 years, and then he started drinking again, and it was like a freight train. through our house. It was absolutely insane asylum. I was coming home all the time, and he was passed out cold. I couldn't wake him up. I couldn't do anything with him. He was on a daily drunk for the last 9 months of his drinking. It was just, I used to come home and pray that his truck would be there. I was coming home praying that it wouldn't be there because I did not know what to do anymore. And somewhere in that insanity, I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. And I remember going to that meeting and sitting in the front row and not wanting to be there at all, absolutely hating my life and hating everything about it, and that now I'm at an Al-Anon meeting with really old people, and that's just how everybody looked to me. And I know that was not the case, but the oldest person there, looking the oldest and looking the most wore out, I know for a fact was me, because I know I was a really old woman when I got here. I have absolutely no doubt about that. And I sat at that meeting and I sat in that front row. And if you're new here and you're looking for a reason not to come, it is so easy. It is so easy not to come here. I mean, because you can find, if you're just looking for a reason not to, you will. And I sat in that front row, and then and as lovely and wonderful and warm and welcome as they made me feel at that meeting, I did not want to be there, and I was looking for why I didn't have to be. And they read it. They said, if somebody's drinking bothers you, then you should come to Al-Anon. Well, wonderful, wonderful. If you're bothered by it, good for you. Where do you go if their drinking pisses you off? Because that's where I'm at. If it just bothered me, I'd be okay. But no, I'm very angry over here. And, pissed off is a whole nother nirvana level. And, maybe all this little crappy stuff works for you guys. You know, your merry-go-round named denial, oh boy, and all that stuff. But if they would have said to me at that meeting, Larsine, do you want your life to be different? God, did I want my life to be different. Larsine, what are you willing to do about it? Not one thing. Not one thing, because it's not me, it's him. You fix him, and I'll be just fine. One more time, information from nowhere lands here and becomes fact for me. Because somewhere I convinced myself that it's his job to make me happy, it's his job, and he's been falling down on it for a very, very long time. And he owes me, and he owes me big. And I'm not going to lift my finger to do another thing. And I'm certainly not going to come to these meetings, even though they were willing to tell me. And they told me that day, we will help you take care of yourself and your children so that you can be happy no matter if the alcoholic is drinking or not drinking. But I couldn't even fathom that. I couldn't even begin to fathom that concept. And so that was my Al-Anon career. And, I still try and get, I think we Al-Anon should have the piece of literature that says how to get them to stop drinking and do what you want them to do. We could keep so many people here if they knew we were. After you come for a year, we'll give you this piece of literature, But you got to come for a year. That's the price. And, but anyway, that was my big Al-Anon career. And then we just went back to the insanity and the craziness and all the stuff going on. And I remember we were having this big family to-do going on, and it was a big deal for me, and it was Butch's family. And I made him promise me, weeks in advance, months in advance, this is going to be this day. Promise me you won't drink. Promise me you won't use. It's really, really important. Of course he promised me, because he meant it when he promised me. I know to this day, I know when my husband's lying to me, when he's telling me the truth, and he was telling me the truth when he said, Larsine, I promise you I will not drink that day. I know with every fiber of his being he wanted to be there for us that day and do what the deal that, we were supposed to do. But of course that day come, and of course he was drunk, because he's an alcoholic and he can't help it. And once he starts drinking, and I was mad. God, I was just, I can't even, to this day, I don't think I've ever been as mad as I was that day. And I remember yelling and screaming and just every bad thing and thought that could come out of my mouth. And then I remember all of a sudden our boys then were 5 and 3 years old, and they were leaning on me and they were tugging on my pant legs, begging me, Mommy, Mommy, please stop yelling at Daddy. And I would like to tell you that I had a moment of clarity then, but I absolutely positively did not. Because what I started doing was I started yelling at those little boys. How dare you tell me to stop yelling at your dad? He's the idiot here. He's the reason our life is crap. He's the reason there's so much pain and agony, blah, 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 in this family, and on and on and on and on. And I know, and by the time I got done yelling at those two little precious kids, I watched my drunken, loaded husband walking out the front door, and I, the sober mother, say to the drunken father, where do you think you're going? And the drunken father turns to the sober mother and says, I'm leaving because we're upsetting the children. And I tell you this story not because I'm proud of it, because this is where the disease of alcoholism took me. And I'm not the person that's drinking or whatever. And I'm thinking I'm unaffected. I think I'm the saint. I think I'm the one that's holding it all together. The family disease of alcoholism does not let you see the truth. I love in our literature where it says how we become... and unreasonable without knowing it. And why? Because we try and force solutions. And that's all I'm about. I'm about taking a round husband and fitting him in my square husband hole. You know, that's just by God how it's going to be. You know, and anyway, you know, we kind of went through the deal, and my husband got, you know, like I say, the last 9 months were absolutely horrific. And I remember coming home one time, and I think I'm protecting our children from this. And my husband was always wonderful with our kids. They were terrified of me, but he was always good with, he's not a mean drunk. And he was always good with the boys. But we'd come home, and Daddy'd be passed out cold. And I didn't know what to do because he'd be doing drugs, and I wouldn't know if I should call the police and if he overdosed, or should I call the paramedics, or should I just let him lie there, or what should I do? You know, and the boys just, they just kind of went with the flow. You know, they'd pretend he was Gulliver and tie Tonka trucks to him and build Tinker Toy bridges over him, you know, and do that whole deal. And then one day, you know, my husband got arrested, which is no big deal. He gets arrested lots of times. But that night that he got arrested, you know, that's the night that he got sober. You know, and on a scale of 1 to 10, I wouldn't give you that last drunk a 5. You know, and why that's the one that got him sober, I can't even begin to tell you, and that's his story. But that's where the miracle started happening for him, and that's where I know God started working in his life. God was not working in mine, but he was working in my husband's life. And my husband had some kind of spiritual awakening that night, and he got arrested for drunk driving, like I said, and back in those days, they released him. This was like in 1979, and so they released him on his own recognizance, you know, and stuff. I just had to pick him up. He was standing outside the police station. He got in the car, and this is how I know God was working in Butch's life and not in mine, because he's been arrested for drunk driving again. He's screwed up big time again. I am loaded for bear. I got nothing but nice things to say, right? But I said nothing. I said absolutely nothing. And believe you me, it takes a power greater than anything you've seen in your life to keep my mouth shut, because I said nothing. And he came home, and he went upstairs, stayed upstairs for 2 days. I didn't go up. He didn't come down. He comes downstairs finally after 2 days and makes that understatement of the century. Oh, I think I have a problem. They are so quick. I just love how quick they are. Do you think? So anyway, but it just so happened that the day before he got arrested, I'd called this hospital, and they just opened this hospital, and they had this program for alcoholism and drug abuse, and it was a brand new deal, and they gave me the number of the doctor on call. And so when he said, you know, I need help, I said, well, here's the number of this hospital. They opened up. You can call them. And again, God working in Butch's life, because I didn't stay. I didn't listen to him make the call. I didn't listen by the door. I absolutely, positively removed myself out of the picture, and he made the call, and he made the arrangements to go into the hospital. And I know for a fact that God was working in his life. And I really believe with all my heart that God literally pushed me out of the way because Butch had asked God for help. And God answered his prayers. And so Butch went into this program, but first they had to detox him. He'd been taking Valium for 100 years and everything else, and they had to detox him from all that stuff. So they put him in the psychiatric unit of this hospital first. And so to cheer him up, the boys then were in kindergarten and preschool, and I'd bring what the boys had made. Oh, look what the boys made for you, you know. And no, he wanted to show me what he made in occupational therapy that day. I take it home, I show the boys, we hang it on the refrigerator. Look, Daddy's sober now, woohoo, you know. It's like, oh boy, this is going to be fun. But after he finished with that part, they introduced him, you know, to the alcoholism treatment part of that program. And from that day to this, he's been sober every single solitary day. And again, my heart knows absolutely no end of gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous for taking a really good guy and letting him live a really full life. And my heart is really, like I say, very, very grateful. I always get teary-eyed at this part. And it's not because he lived, because I was rooting for death at this point. I really was. I wanted to be a widow so bad. I mean, I really did. But what I always think about now is what happened then, was how angry I was. And my husband was close to death. I have absolutely no doubt about that. But I know that had my husband died that way, and the anger and the rage that was in me, and I think about those two little boys that were 5 and 3 years old, and I wonder what kind of family I would be with those two little boys that were 5 and 3 if I had nothing but anger and rage to bring, because that's the family disease of alcoholism. And that's why I'm always so very, very grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous, plus the fact that now I am glad he lived, because he really did turn out to be a So anyway, he started going to this, and back then they didn't have any intensive family crap. You know, it was all about the alcoholic. It's always all about the alcoholic. And, you know, what I should do, how I should act, clean this out, do this. You know, I got a whole list of things to do, and we're all supposed to be really nice because he's getting sober now. And give me the book to read. The family afterward chapter to the wives gag me with a spoon. I mean, I was just like, oh my God. And but I'm a rule regulation person, and I will be supportive even if it kills me. And so he went through the program, and he came home, and then he fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous from the very beginning. And he went to the meetings, and he did the book, and he was sponsored, and he was having an absolutely wonderful time. And I was loving the first year. I went with him the first 6 months to make sure he heard everything that he was supposed to hear, because he needs my help. And but you know, after 6 months, I got tired of going to AA. I'm like, good God, there's only 12 steps. How stupid are you? Let's go, let's go, let's go. And, you know, but he made it clear to me that AA was the most important thing in his life. And he was going to do that till the day he died. That was just the name of the tune. I could like it or I could not like it. And so anyway, so I was told to go to a Al-Anon meeting when he was in this program. I went to a Al-Anon meeting. I told them at that Al-Anon meeting, you know, I came to you guys, I don't know, a year ago. I asked you how to get my husband sober. You didn't tell me squat hola, so I'm not going to tell you how I got him sober now. And thank you very much. I am done. And that was, you know, because that's just my attitude about it. I came to you, you gave me nothing. Now, I wasn't sure what I had done, but I was fully, it was all my doing. I had no doubt about it. And but anyway, he kept going to AA, and he just kept getting weller and weller, and I just kept getting sicker and sicker, because as much as I loved him being sober, I just couldn't turn off the mad. I couldn't turn off the anger. I couldn't turn off the bad feelings, the always looking for the dark side, always feeling crappy about everything. I could not turn it off. And so and here he is, you know, now almost 2 years sober, going to meetings. You know, I always say, when Butch is a good husband, I'm going to be fine. When Butch is a good father, when he goes to work every day, you know, and brings home a regular paycheck, I'm going to be just fine. And here he is 2 years into sobriety, and he's beyond any expectation that I had for him. And I was anything but fine. And it's like my friend Crazy Jean used to say, it's like they get sober and you're out of a job, you know, because that's just what it was like. I just did not know where to go with any of this stuff anymore. So after I went with him to a conference in Palm Springs, and he tricked me into going to the family meeting, and you know, and for me, that's where I became this much willing. I sat at the family meeting where they had an AA speaker, an Al-Anon speaker, and an Alateen speaker, and they were in no way related. But just sitting in that room, I became this much willing to start to do something different. So when I came back from that conference, I started going to Al-Anon, and I started going to Al-Anon for all the right reasons. I didn't come here to get an alcoholic sober. He already was. I didn't come to keep him sober. He was doing fine on his own. I came because I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I'm a rule and regulation person. They said, you get a sponsor, you work the steps, you go to meetings, you read the literature, hallelujah, sign me up, here I am. You know, and I got into that really, really fast. I got a sponsor right away, but I didn't get a, you know, I hear people in Al-Anon forever saying, oh, I don't have a sponsor because I can't find somebody like me. Why do you want somebody like you? Ugh, that would be terrible. She'll know what you're thinking. Oh, that's even worse. And, you know, so I got a sponsor the complete opposite of me. She was older than my mother. She had a thick Dutch accent. She could hardly understand a bloody word she said. And she was divorced from her alcoholic, had never lived with sobriety, you know, did not have any children. We had absolutely nothing in common. You know, and I asked her to be my sponsor. And I remember the very first time I used her as a sponsor, Butch was going to work that morning, and he had a dead battery, and I jumped it, and after I jumped his car, he ran out of gas. Now, this made him angry, and I used to say he yelled at me. What I know is it just made him angry, and he yelled about it. But he yelled, there was rules about that. He yells, I yell, that's the rule. And then he storms off to work. I went upstairs, called my sponsor, and reported his very bad behavior. And then when I was done, she says, well, when Butch comes home tonight, you tell him you're sorry for what you said. It was unnecessary and uncalled for. And I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, Jeannie doesn't know how we do things in America. And she obviously missed some really crucial stuff. And at any rate, so I started telling her the story again because she missed something in there. And halfway through the second telling, she says, don't tell me what you just told me. I heard you the first time. And another thing, don't you ever call and start a conversation with Butch said or Butch did. I don't care what Butch says or does. I am Larsine's sponsor. And for what Larsine said, she owes her husband an amends. I'll see you at the meeting tonight. Goodbye, click, end of conversation. We are done. I learned valuable lessons. Never call. sponsor first thing in the morning, because you got all day long to think about what she told you. That'll do you in. You'll never call your sponsor when you're going to see her that night at the meeting, because she's going to want to know if you follow direction. And I'm a rule and regulation person. I have no choice. I have to do it. So that night when Butch got home, I had all day to think about it. He walked in the door. I said, "I'm sorry I let your shitty attitude affect me the way that it did. And I will try and do better in the future." Now, I know that that is not the best amends that you can make. But I had never told him I was sorry for nothing, because it was always his fault. And that day, because of you, I was this much willing to do something different. And I'm here to tell you that that's all you have to be, is just this much willing. I see people beat themselves out of Al-Anon all the time because they don't think it's working for them, or it's not working fast enough. There's nothing about fat. There's just this much at a time. And if you can see this much at a time, you are way ahead. This is how we do it here. If there was some magic wand that we could give you 25 years of serenity at a whack, we'd be whacking you for 25 grand, believe you me. You know, but there's no such thing as that. You know, if you want 25 years, you got to come for 25 years. You got to go to the meetings. You got to work the step. You got to do the deal. And it's a slow process. But man, is it worth it. Is it worth it? That day it was worth it to me, even though I said it was his crappy attitude, because I was this much willing to make a step away instead of it permanently being his fault for the rest of our life till death do us part. Because that was the deal. Somebody once said to me, "Why didn't you just divorce him?" And I was like, "And let him win?" I don't think so. I don't think so. And but anyway, you know, but pretty much from this day, you know, that day to this, it's been just this much at a time. You know, we've had our ups, we've had our downs. You know, but our life is generally good, because what I got to learn here is happiness is an inside job. He can't hand it to me on a silver platter. You can't give it to me no matter what. I've got to find it within. And I found it within sitting in rooms with people like you, learning to laugh about the stuff that absolutely used to tear me up. Because alcoholism is dark, and it only wants you to see the dark. It means to keep you in the dark. And the program and the steps and a higher power and sponsorship are all about love and light. And at first, the light really hurts. I mean, it's just like I couldn't even bear to look at any of it, because it was just, it was way, way too much for me. But as I gradually got used to it, and I got to see the bright colors and the goodness that is in everything, if I let myself see it, the gratitude that is in everything, if I let myself look for it instead of the dark side. And I want you to know, I am such a sick person all the time. I just got a couple really quick stories I want to share with you just to show you how sick I remain at any given time. And this was like, I was about 15 years in Al-Anon at this point. Butch and I had been to a conference much like this, wonderful speakers, terrific workshops, and you come home and you're in Sunday, and you know how, like, ooh, you walk in the door and serenity's like coming out of every orifice of your body. Wow, you know, because you're just all full of the program. Well, that was that kind of a weekend, and we walk in, and for exercise, I have a treadmill in the garage, and that's what I like to do. And so I went in to go exercise, and at that time, our youngest son was at home, 19, having many, many problems, and I was very, very fearful for this kid. And I walk into my exercise, my treadmill, and there's my son's weight bench. And on this weight bench, I find a driver's license, and I pick it up, and it's a woman, and she's 32 years old, and she lives in Glendora, California, because that's on the driver's license. And I immediately decide she's been in my house over the weekend, had sex with my 19-year-old son, wants to marry him, has two kids, and call me mom. I am there right now. And, you know, information from nowhere, woo-hoo, lands here, we're gone. And so I run into the house, and my husband's laying on the couch, and I show him the driver's license, and nothing, because the guy's got no imagination whatsoever. I mean, he's got nothing. And I tell him what I think happened over the weekend. His eyes roll back in his head. He's like, "Call Carol. Carol's my sponsor now. You are nuts. You are wacky." So I call Carol. Carol agrees with Butch. And, you know, and she rarely gives me specific direction, but that day she told me to shut up. Shut up. And don't you dare say to that kid when he walks in the door the garbage and the crap that you made up. He's got enough stuff going on in his life without you dumping crap. You're just making up crap now to make him even feel worse about himself. Don't you say one word to him. Well, as it turns out, I don't see him for a couple of days. And so 2 days later, he comes in the kitchen, and now I forgot about the driver's license because it's been 2 days. All kinds of stuff's come and gone here already, big emergencies. And he walks in with a driver's license, and he says, "Mom, what do you do when you find a driver's license?" And I don't tell him what I do when I find a driver's license. Because it's not a good example. Not a good example. But, you know, here's 15 years in Al-Anon, going to meetings, working. doing the deal. My husband's sober. People go, why do you go to Al-Anon? 10 seconds alone in the garage. That's why I go to Al-Anon. Because I will go to the dark side by myself any given time. Any given time, I will go there and make up this terrible stuff. But what the gift is that I come to you with it and you say, garbage, throw it away, that's not a real thing. Let's get into reality. Let's get into how we really feel. Someone once told me too, you know, when you're fearful about your kids, it takes just as much energy to send positive thoughts their way as it does the fearful ones. Which ones do you want to be sending? You know, unconditional love is not just some little cute saying we have here. There is so much meaning behind everything that goes on here if you look for it. 2 years ago, we found out 3 years ago that we were going to become grandparents. My oldest son was going to have a son, and I was just beyond joy. You know, I've been waiting. This kid's like 30 years old. Good God, get on with it already. So anyway, we're going to have a grandson, and I was thrilled. And, you know, and they know instantaneously when they're pregnant now. So as it turns out, I knew the baby was going to be born in May. And it turns out every weekend in May, I have a commitment, and I am gone. And so Butch says, you know, you might want to get out of those if you want to be here when the baby's born. And I'm like, no, that's okay. I know it's going to work out okay because I prayed to God. I told God that this baby was coming and it could not be born on the weekend. Now, I don't ask God for much. I am here to tell you. I am a humble servant all the time. And I just wanted this little weeny favor, you know, and so God, this is really important to me. Please, God, don't let this baby be born on the weekend. And I saw God, his head went like this. I know that he knew. And so sure enough, baby's not born. Last weekend, I'm in like Iowa or some place that's very close to the Canadian border. I'm very bad at geography. Anyway, one plane in this place, one place out of this, you know, and it's Friday, I just got to make it home Sunday, and I'm scot-free. The plane, no, as soon as the plane lands, Butch calls me, the baby has been born. I am pissed beyond mortal belief. I am so angry. I just can't even. And I'm at this conference, and these people are so happy that I'm there. And I hate their guts. I just hate their guts. And so I'm at this dinner thing. I excuse myself from the table because I know what I got to do. And I call my sponsor, and I am mad, angry. This is so screwed. It's not fair. This, when you get to be there for your family, this sucks. I'm quitting Al-Anon. I'm done. This is crap. Blah, blah, blah. Hang up the phone. And then no sooner do I hang up the phone than the phone rings again, and it's Charlotte. And Charlotte is my sponsor. Now, I don't know how it is in Texas, but in California, when your sponsor calls you, you've crossed the line. Whoa, you're way over here. You're way over there. But of course, I know better than to yell at her, so now I do the other tactic. Oh, Charlotte, the baby's born. It isn't fair. I want to be there with the baby. And then Charlotte, in her very, very loving voice, Arsene, did you turn your will and your life over to the care of God today? Yes, I did. I do it every day. And she says, then you are exactly where you are supposed to be, doing exactly what you are supposed to be doing. She goes, another thing, a beautiful thing has happened. You have a healthy baby grandson that was born today. The mother is fine. Everything went great. Your son is as happy as he can be. And yet you want to take this beautiful event that happened and make it be ugly and make it be all about you. You know, and one more time, here I am. This is 2 years ago, and this is where I will go when I stay by myself. But when I go to you guys, you just bring me back to where I'm supposed to be, to the beauty that is around me all the time. That I just, the disease of alcoholism doesn't want me to see. It wants me to make it be about me because I made the rules and regulations about how the baby's supposed to be born, and I had to be there. And in reality, the package didn't come the way that I wanted it to come one more time, but wasn't it just as precious as it was? And so I'm there, and I got a credit card, and I got a phone. I sent flowers, cakes, clothes, telegrams, grandma's coming. And then I figured out my flight back would get me there within 48 hours of the baby being born, so I just made a minor adjustment to the rules and regulations. If I see the baby in the first 48 hours, that will count, you know, and do whatever. Because what I've learned here is if you stay rigid, you will break. You will absolutely, positively break. So if you are making up those rules and regulations that are keeping you from having a good time, that are keeping you from letting other people be who they need to be, then you need to re-examine them. When I lead the meeting in my group, my topic is always what stick is up your butt. You know, because you need to pull that sucker out, you know, and get on with getting on and having a good time. Because happiness is an inside job. I got a little candle that I... home, and it's just this little wooden candle, and on it's a little saying. It just says, a candle loses nothing of its light by lighting another candle. I want to thank you guys from the bottom of my heart for lighting my candle. Thank you.